Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started, if that's okay. Welcome to order the meeting of the Private Activity Bond Committee. There's a number of people in the room, and hopefully they're all signing in. If the people on the phone could identify themselves for the official record, please.
This is Brandon Delk and Tom Crow from Pedcor Investments.
And Harvey Rogers from Hawkins Delafield. We're bond counsel.
Mark Glotfeldy from Goldman Sachs.
Larry Holzgang, Business Oregon.
John Ferris with Business Oregon.
Red Rock Fort Collins office.
Nelda Newton with Wells Fargo.
Anyone else?
Yes, this is Tom Cusack in Lake Oswego.
Great. Well, I said last time that those are the most people that have ever attended a PAB meeting since I've worked for the state for the last 14 years, and today has proved me wrong because I think we even have more people. So welcome to all. We have a fairly full agenda, so we'll try and get through this as swiftly as possible. We usually start with status updates. With Martha, will you walk us through that?
The carry forward 2014 allocations were $274.9 million.
I'm sorry, could you speak up?
Martha, do you have a microphone near you?
No.
She'll be right there. We're just going over the part of the package that reviews our historical carry forward allocations and use summary.
2014 carry forward allocation used was $274.9 million and expired $57.6 million. 2015 carry forward balance so far has used $196 million and has a couple more years for $167 million to be used. 2016 allocation has used $51 million with a balance of $328.7 million. Still to be used before expiration. The carry forward 2017 carry forward balance today for the committee's consideration to allocate is $251.8 million and 2018 current cap legislative allocation and increase from IRS cap per capita and population formula leaves the committee with $264,991,480 in 2018 current cap.
Okay. Committee members, any questions on the numbers? We are using the same format every time.
Right. And that helps. Thank you.
My only observation is I'm proud that we reduced the amount that we weren't able to use of carry forward to 57. I think it's an indication that Oregon Housing and other housing groups have been pretty busy and pretty active. And I kind of anticipate that will be the case on a going forward basis. So I think that's a good problem to have. So other questions?
No.
Okay. Great. Well, then let's just dive right into our allocation requests. The first item of business is to address our carry forward for 17. And the request, we have one request in from Oregon Housing Community Services for multifamily housing. So if those folks want to come to the front table and introduce themselves and walk us through their request. There's a few new people who have joined the call since we started. Could you just briefly introduce yourselves for the record?
Laura, this is John Saris. I apologize. I'm kind of in between Cottage Grove and Roseburg, so that was me.
Okay, no worries.
And you
Annette
have
Lieber.
Yep, sorry.
Annette Lieber, Regional Solutions.
And Justin Goldstein, Goldman Sachs.
Great, thank you. Okay, Margaret.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair and Committee members. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And with me today is
Bob Larson, the Debt Manager of the Department.
Wonderful. Oregon Housing and Community Services is requesting $250 million of carry-forward authority available from the State of Oregon's unused 2017 current year private activity bond allocation. If received, our agency will use the private activity bond carry forward allocation to issue $250 million of bonds for multifamily qualified residential rental projects. Our agency produced historic levels of financing activity, which the chair had referenced, in both multifamily and single family bond programs in 2017. The following is a brief summary of the accomplishments and the current thinking of and projection for the multifamily and single-family bond programs for the committee's consideration. I'll start with the single-family program. In 2017, the residential bond loan program purchased 640 mortgage loans totaling approximately $133.8 million, which is the largest number and amount of mortgage loans purchased in any calendar year since 2008, and you'll all recall that 2008 was really the beginning of the recession period. This amount of loan activity more than doubled the $60.3 million in mortgage loans purchased in 2016. In 2017, approximately 26% of the single-family loans purchased were for borrowers at or below 80% of area median income. At least 19.8% of the borrowers served in 2017 were minority households. OHCS made loans in 27 counties in 2017 and continues to have active loans in 33 of Oregon's 36 counties. The residential loan program currently has 8 active participating lenders, but in this next year, we expect to add an additional 25 new lenders to the program, which is an exciting expansion opportunity for us. Historically, OHCS has been one of Oregon's largest investors in USDA Rural Development Guaranteed Rural Housing Loans. In 2017, OHCS purchased 133 loans totaling 27.7 that were insured by the USDA Rural Development Loan Program. Currently, OHCS is reserving 30-year fixed-rate mortgage loans at 3.25% for rate advantage loans and 3.75% for cash advantage loans, which provides 3% for closing cost assistance. OHCS currently has 95 loan reservations totaling approximately $20.5 million. OHCS continues to use various financing techniques and opportunities, including economic refundings of previously issued bonds, blending of bond proceeds from different bond issues, and use of recycled prepayments to finance single-family mortgage loans under the current bond program. OHCS currently has approximately $68 million of 0% proceeds created from refunding transactions in 2015, 2016, and 2017, which are available to be blended with new money and recycled bond proceeds. This allows our agency to continue to offer interest rates for single-family mortgage loans significantly below market rate for the next several years. And now I'll turn to the multifamily programs. In 2017, OHCS financed 12 multifamily projects with pass-through revenue bond issuance totaling approximately $174.3 million, which is the largest amount of multifamily bond issuance in any year in the agency's history. With these resources, OHCS was able to create or preserve more than 1,300 units of multifamily housing. Of these 1,343 total housing units financed from 2017 bond issuance, 1,277 units, or 95.1%, will provide rental housing for residents at or below 60% of area median income, and 1,338 units, 99.6%, will provide rental housing for residents at or below 80% of area median income. In this next year, 2018, OHCS expects to use it to increase issuance of tax-exempt bonds to finance affordable multifamily housing under the agency's pass-through revenue conduit bond program in an effort to address the affordable housing crisis across Oregon. Current estimates for 2018 issuance include financing totaling approximately $183.4 million for 1,748 housing units in 17 projects. These projects are located all throughout the state, including Portland, Salem, Eugene, Hillsboro, Tigard, St. Helens, Winston, Central Point, White City, Yahas, and more. OHCS currently has received applications from multifamily housing developers looking to finance 4 projects through the issuance of pass-through revenue bonds prior to April 30, 2018, in an aggregate amount of approximately $52.5 million. These projects will create 575 housing units. And during calendar years 2018, 2019, and 2020, OHCS expects to receive an additional $64 million of local innovation and fast track or LIFT proceeds, an additional $45 million of preservation funds for the financing of affordable multifamily projects throughout the state. Many of these funds are expected to be used in conjunction with the proceeds of private activity bond issuance and the companion 4% low-income housing tax credit program, which we typically use to accompany the private activity bond proceeds. During this 3-year period, OHCS estimates that approximately $153.6 million of private activity bonds could be issued for the LIFT projects, and approximately $165 million of private activity bonds could be issued for the preservation projects. The committee has a detail on the current OHCF private activity bond status. I won't go through each of those numbers, but I will make a couple of additional comments for you. Since OHCF expects the remaining just over $167 million of 2015 carry forward to be sufficient to meet single-family issuance needs through 2018, and because we have the large amount of multifamily issuance projected through 2020, we are proposing that all $250 million of OHCF 2017 carry forward requests would be elected for qualified residential rental projects on the multifamily program, not the single-family program. The remaining 2016 carry forward, together with the $250 million requested for the 2017 current year private activity bond allocation, is expected to be sufficient to meet OHCS's multifamily issuance needs through the end of 2019. So our agency, in sum, is respectfully requesting an allocation of 2017 private activity bond carry forward in the amount of $250 million. We will elect this allocation to be used for qualified residential rental projects. To the extent that additional 2017 private activity bond carry forward allocation is available and allocated to the agency, we would propose that those additional amounts also be elected for the purpose of financing multifamily qualified residential rental projects. We appreciate the support received from the Private Activity Bond Committee in previous years, which has allowed the agency to work so hard to address the state's needs for affordable housing. This allocation would be a very useful resource to assist OHCF in future efforts to continue to address that need. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. I'd also like to add that the LIFT program, there's a constitutional amendment to give them even more flexibility. It's HJR 202.
Right.
And that would allow them to do grants or loans where we don't necessarily have to own the property. So I think that will even expand your horizon in terms of various creative ways.
And that'll be on the May ballot?
Well, I guess it has to go to the legislature
right.
first.
But that's the target?
I don't know.
The target is November.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So I think that you guys are going to be cranking out a lot of bonds.
And I would add to that that there are actually two constitutional amendments being proposed. So one is to address the structure of the LIFT program, so the state authority on these programs, on the general obligation bond programs. But the companion constitutional amendment proposal has to do with the municipal bond structure, and so we have some municipalities and regions in Oregon that are looking at their own bond programs, which currently cannot be paired with the 4% low-income housing tax
right.
credit or private activity bonds because of the way those legal structures are in place. If those constitutional amendments do pass, then we would be fully expecting our partners and local jurisdictions to be coming to us to look at the 4% and conduit bond structure to pair with those.
And they'll be coming to us
well.
For PAB allocations.
Understood. More
so you may have lots of people that are meeting
coming
on a going forward basis. Okay. Any questions from board members?
This is probably a Mr. Larson question, but first of all, I think your forward calendar is terrific. It's great to see this kind of, you know, both project-specific and sort of a more generalized treatment of out-year demand. It's very helpful. I did notice that there are two different kinds of preservation, big P and little P in here, and I don't understand the difference, but I'll bet you do.
So for what it's worth, Bob, I gave them the material you gave me in December, which had that detailed spreadsheet, so just so you know what he's talking about.
Well, I'm actually going to kick the can to Julie Cody.
Oh, well, I have actually very technical terms, big P and little P. No, I'm actually joking. We're actually working on coming up with some better terminology for this. But when we look at preserving the existing stock of affordable housing, which is such a critical need, I know the committee
sure.
Recognizes that need, we actually have two different categories of properties that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
What is sometimes called big P, and again, it's a clunky term, are properties that have federal subsidies attached to them.
Got
so
it.
They have federal rental assistance contracts either through housing authorities, through HUD rental assistance contracts, or through USDA rural development.
It's what we used to refer to as expiring use.
Yes,
Got
yes,
it.
And they often have underlying federal use agreements as well.
Right.
What we're recognizing is an emerging need for us to address and was actually a topic of a Secretary of State performance audit that was published last year looking at our agency's programs is something that is often termed little P. Again, needs a better name. But these are properties that are in OHCS's portfolio, may have received either a 4% or 9% award or some other program, but don't necessarily have those federal rent assistance contracts on them. They are just as vulnerable to obsolescence and aging property needs, but they don't have that rent assistance. So there's just a different financial structure and a little bit different approach typically taken.
That's clear. Thank you.
You could call it federal partnership preservation versus whatever the other name is.
We'll follow up with you, Chair,
on those terms. I'm good at branding.
We'll remember that.
And there's sort of a third category, which is essentially old, unsubsidized tax credit projects that are coming off their original restriction periods, many of which have material recapitalization needs.
And those are typically included in that bucket of the little P.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Other preservation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes me feel bad. Okay. Questions? I would entertain a motion, and I assume you'll be happy if we give you the full amount, which is the $251,826.689.99, because we're down to the penny this year.
We can certainly make use of that extra.
Yeah. I would move that the entire balance of 2017 carry forward be allocated to Oregon Housing and Community Services in support of its multifamily programs.
I second it.
All in favor, I'll say aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee members.
Go forth and conquer. Okay, now let's take a look at our allocation request for 2018, current allocations. As Martha said, we have a number of applicants coming forward today. I thought we would start in the agenda package with Red Rock, since that was the folks that we spoke with most recently in December. So if the Red Rock team wants to come, including bank attorneys, who I'm sure will have questions. Thank you, and state your names for the record, please.
So I'm David Weiss with Business Oregon.
Carol Matu with Hawkins, Delafield & Wood, Bond Counsel.
Jennifer Cordova, Hawkins, Delafield & Wood, Bond Counsel.
And Jeff Manternack, Red Rock Biofuel.
So before us today is, as you remember, the other half of the request that we were discussing in our meeting in late December. So maybe, Jeff, you might would start with recent developments. Tell us a little bit about the transaction that you did close in late December and what's before us today.
Sure. Happy to report that with our financial advisors, Goldman Sachs, who's on the phone today, and Stern Brothers, and all of our counsel, including Hawkins Devilfield, who's here today, and assistance from Business Oregon and lots of other project partners, we did successfully close on approximately $245 million of taxable and tax-exempt bonds. That includes the $110 million of tax-exempt that was allocated last December from the PABC. And so in combination with $135.5 million of taxable bonds, we were able to close the entire financing round on December 27th, and we are working quite hard as the wider project team now to work through all of the documentation required for remarketing of those bonds with an expected remarketing date of April 5th, which is the same one that was anticipated last go round. Everything so far is on track. There are lots of final documentation happening, as you might imagine, and looks like we're poised for a successful remarketing on April 5th. With that, perhaps Business Oregon, David Weiss would like to say a few words.
Yep, I've got some prepared remarks, and I'll cut out what Jeff just said. I can. So Business Oregon is requesting, on behalf of Red Rock Biofuels, that PABC approve $105 million in current year 2018 private activity bond allocation for the Red Rock Biofuels LLC Clean Energy Project. So I'll keep this short, and then I was hoping we could open it up for questions, and we do have various people here to answer those questions. So this is the fourth time this project has come to PABC, so as Jeff has said, there aren't major changes to the project since the last meeting in December, as we've described in the last three meetings. This is a 300 million plus facility which will convert woody biomass to jet fuel. It's going to be located in Lake County in Southern Oregon. It's projected to create 31 new full-time direct permanent jobs, good average annual wages of $52,000 a year, in addition to other job impacts from construction and multiplier effects. So a couple of things since the last meeting a month ago. Our finance committee has approved a bond closing resolution. We've obtained the governor's TEFRA approval, obviously, because the closing happened again on December 27th. So that was the initial mode of escrow closing in late December. Those short-term bonds were sold to a qualified institutional buyer, but we learned this week that they've gone back to Goldman Sachs. So they own those short-term bonds currently. So the January 10th memo you got with your packet, it details the source and uses for the escrow closing on December 27th and our understanding at the time of the April 28th project mode financing. So Monday of this week, I know you've gotten several updates, and it's probably hard to keep track of all of them, but the Monday updates are the current understanding of sources and uses and bond series for the April 2018 closing. And that would add a taxable series of about $3 million to help cover costs of issuance in excess of the 2% of the tax-exempt bonds, which can cover COI. So the final amount of the tax-exempt bonds may change slightly as the tax due diligence is completed, but we are requesting that PABC approve the full requested $105 million in allocation. Whatever is needed, whatever qualifies, would be used, and whatever isn't would go back to the committee.
And David, you might want to mention your department is also
yes.
going to be allocated.
Good segue. That was
good. Yeah, because the numbers wouldn't add up otherwise.
So Business Oregon, so we have $40 million in the agency allocation for this calendar year. We have a $10 million small issue manufacturing facility, IDB, which is working its way through the process. So we're prepared to commit the balance of the $30 million or $40 million in allocation for this project. So based on the current bond documents, if the bonds are not remarketed or refunded and do not close by April 5th, this whole deal would unwind, and PABC's $105 million, if approved, will go back to PABC to be used for other projects, either for current year 2018 allocation or in the 2018 carry-forward pool towards the end of the year. So Business Oregon is highly supportive of the Red Rock Biofuels project in terms of the economic development impacts, the job creation, environmental impacts, other benefits for a rural Oregon community. However, due to the fact this is a startup business utilizing new technology, high leverage, lack of third-party equity investment for the 2018 bond closing for a $338 million total project cost, the department continues to maintain a neutral position on the proposed plan of financing for the project. So in conclusion, Business Oregon is requesting on behalf of Red Rock Biofuels that PABC approve a current year 2018 allocation of $105 million for the project. So with that, I'd be happy to take questions, and I'd be even happier to have the other guests here to ask some of the detailed questions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Some of my questions, I have to be honest, I have my other hat where I'm the person signing the legal documents, so I've asked these questions a few days ago, but I think it's important for the committee and for the public record. So that's why I really wanted bond counsel here today to walk us through, because the change in the numbers as we've seen them over the last few weeks has to do with cost of issuance I think I mentioned that there's a 2% limit, and Jennifer Cordova, our tax counsel from Hawkins, can talk about that. But they've been able to find some previously expended dollars as sort of to allow us to kind of keep the dollar amount of the borrowing about the same. So could you talk us through the due diligence process you went to? Because the new numbers now have a 2% of cost of issuance, but we are seeing some numbers in the sources and uses where we're reimbursing Red Rock for some previous expenses, which they'll then use to pay some of those same issuance costs.
Yeah. So yes, in the current set of numbers, there are, bond proceeds directly being used for more than 2% of the tax deductible for cost of issuance, some additional amount being covered by the taxable series within the numbers, and then the rest would be covered by other cash. And where that other cash would come from is, has been contemplated during the various approving resolutions. There's always been a declaration of intent there and a thought that Red Rock could be paying costs of the project that would be eligible to ultimately be reimbursed from the tax and bond issuance. And so...
And they're not federal grant dollars that we're reimbursing them
right,
for.
Right, right.
Just to be real clear, because the federal grant has been drawn down, so this was the Red Rock's match to the federal grant in the first phases of the project.
That's right. We would need to make sure that they were... real costs of the project that were paid by Red Rock, not by the federal grant or other dedicated sources, that were costs paid to third parties, not internal or related party costs, that would be eligible costs of the project that could be reimbursed. And Red Rock has provided us with a very detailed spreadsheet of those costs. I still need to go through them and verify the exact number, so that reimbursement number could shift a bit, but those are the costs based on the parameters that we provided to Red Rock that they've determined they think qualify and as a reimbursement. And so, of course, if they're reimbursed costs, previously paid costs, they're eligible. Once those reimbursements are made to Red Rock, reimbursement of their equity, which then they would, I understand, plan on using to pay some of the excess cost of issuance, which under the tax rules would be fine.
Okay. So that, I just want to get that on the record. Questions from committee members?
Yeah. No, that's helpful because it addresses the issue or concern that we raised last time about
exactly.
The cost of issuance, so that's helpful explanation.
But it does mean that there is relatively little cash equity in this transaction.
Still.
And, but having said that, it was a creative way for the financing team to come up with a way to make it work. I think I heard April 5th closed, but I thought I heard you say April 18th, so to be real clear, are we still on target?
April 18th?
Well, I don't know if I heard that wrong, but it's the 5th, right?
Correct.
Okay.
The 5th is targeted closing.
Okay. And if we don't have new buyers, there's escrow securities that will pay off the bonds. Okay, because that's what we did in the 27th,
right.
Which was we sold some bonds and we bought some treasury securities and escrowed those bonds. So we're covered from that perspective. Again, these are conduit revenue bonds. It's not an obligation, direct obligation to the state of Oregon, which it'll say in the legal docs. Just for the record, the permanent financing will still be a limited public offering. Could somebody from Goldman or Hawkins talk about the type of buyers that you plan to sell the permanent financing to?
Sure. Perhaps Mark Glatfelty from Goldman Sachs.
Yes. Hi, this is Mark. We are targeting qualified institutional buyers. So these are large, sophisticated investors in the tax-exempt market, and we're going to limit the purchase of the securities to 35 investors or less. Each investor will be required to sign an investor letter confirming that they are a qualified institutional buyer.
But there will be a limited public offering.
There will be a limited public offering, correct.
Document, though, in terms of the deal plan,
yes.
The risk, etc.
Yes, the preliminary limited offering memorandum clearly states that it's been intended to be sold to qualified institutional buyers only, and there is a risk factor section in the document that lists the key risks to the transaction. And all the investors will have an opportunity to enter the data room and review all the pertinent project contracts supporting the transaction. And all of the qualified institutional buyers will be represented by Purchasers Council, who we have already retained, which is Greenberg Traug.
Sounds good.
And the preliminary offering memorandum is available today.
I haven't seen it.
In draft form.
I have to review my staff, and we will. DOJ will be reviewing that.
Yes.
So that's all kind of going to happen between now and April.
Yeah. Downstream of your review, I'd love to see a copy of it.
Sure.
What we can do is, as we execute the documents,
right,
you'll be
good.
Able to get one.
Understood.
Because it'll be public information at that point.
Okay.
Any questions?
Yeah, I've got a couple.
Sure.
Give us a real focused update on the present status of the DPA grants. Are there any hurdles to that funding being released? Has it been released?
So it is a reimbursable style award. We incur the expense or spend the cash, submit for invoice, and then it comes back. So in terms of the cash, all $70 million is still available. With closing on the 27th, we simultaneously received a notice to proceed on the Phase 2 that is essentially only conditioned upon the closing on April 5th.
Okay.
And copies of that have been reviewed by all of the attorneys.
So other than having a closing on April 5th and then submitting appropriate evidence of payment, there are no impediments?
Correct.
Okay. Next question. I was looking through the status report dated January 5th, 2018. Under Roman III, fuel offtake, you kind of briefly discuss diesel fuel. Give us a sense for what portion of both the jet fuel and separately the diesel fuel estimated output of the plant is now under forward contract.
Sure. So 100% of the jet fuel of the plant is under forward contract with a couple major air carriers.
Mm-hmm.
We've previously announced publicly Southwest and
right.
FedEx. We are in talks with a number of project partners, other air carriers, to take our diesel fuel for blending into conventional jet fuel. That's a process that is currently underway at ASTM to allow renewable diesel to be blended into conventional jet. So we're in talks with a number of air carriers about doing exactly that. As of yet, none of our renewable diesel volume is contracted. We do expect that to happen over the ensuing months. Ideally, it would be by April 5th, but we think it still makes sense for the project to do that even before construction is finished. So even if it doesn't happen in the next 2 months by close, it's something that we will continue to pursue.
Do the numbers work either way as far as cash
yes,
flow?
Yes. So even once forward contracted, the sort of the values, you know, we're producing what is essentially a commodity product and selling it at what ultimately amounts to a market price, even if that market price might be protected by a floor or some other type arrangement. So regardless, the financial model works and the revenues come.
And again, I sort of forgive me for not sort of understanding the mix of product generated by the plant, but what portion of projected gross revenues once the plant runs through its prove-up trials and is online and producing come from that which is currently under contract versus that which is not under contract?
Sure. So the plant will produce roughly 40% jet fuel, 40% diesel fuel, and 20% gasoline blend stock. And when you consider the three or four values for each of the fuels, you have the base fuel itself, kind of the chemical gallon, plus you have assorted environmental credits associated with those gallons. And when you look at all of those, the three products essentially carry the same value, right? The jet, the diesel, the naphtha. So all of the jet, all 40%, is contracted. So that means that roughly 40% of the project's revenues are also forward contracted, because the fuels essentially are worth almost the same amount per gallon.
Okay. And 60% is not contracted?
Correct. 60% is non-contracted. The contracted volumes today would result in the same dollar per gallon of revenue to the plant as the spot volumes today.
Okay. The environmental credits, is, I gather that's something quantifiable and economic?
Absolutely, yes. So,
and it's dependent on federal statutes currently in effect, remaining in effect?
Well, so there's a number of different environmental sort of broadly credits that would apply to the production and blending and use of these fuels. It does differ a little bit from one fuel to the other, but you have various federal and state environmental policies that reward producers and blenders and users for producing and blending and using these fuels. So at the federal level, you have the renewable fuel standard, under which producers generate renewable identification numbers, RINs. That provides a fair bit of revenue for each one of those fuels. To the extent that they're sold in California or Oregon, each of those states has an independent renewable fuels sort of policy, broadly speaking. Mm-hmm. California's is the low carbon fuel standard. That is a little further along than Oregon's clean fuel standard, but that looks at the carbon intensity of fuels, and producers like Red Rock and other producers of renewable fuels sort of earn credits the lower that the carbon score of those fuels goes. And then there are two others. There's a California cap and trade program in place, which is applicable to refiners and other participants, so that potentially some of our fuels might benefit from that. And then finally, there's a federal blenders and producers tax credit program that's part of the tax extenders policy that, or tax extenders package, excuse me, that our fuels would qualify under if that tax extenders package were to be extended by current Congress, as it has been historically. Currently, that's not part of the picture, but it may be going forward. Don't know.
Right. But what I'm taking away from this is I'm sort of less concerned about the stability of the political environment in California than the federal policy environment. But, you know, and this is hardly unique to Red Rock, but all producers of these kinds of products seem to be under some kind of potential political event risk, which would potentially adversely affect the value of their product.
It's certainly possible. You know, I've been in the industry since 2003. Our management team has other members that have been in it for almost 10 years longer than I have. You know, one of the important things to, I think, consider is that renewable fuels tend to be both a blue and red or Democratic and Republican issue, and they tick off kind of different ideas for each one. There's national security, and there's domestic manufacturing, and then there's the environmental benefits. And so it also is important to remember that it started, renewable fuels production started in the heartland in all of the farm states.
Mr. Grassley, or Senator Grassley, is well associated with it.
Exactly. And so there tends to be bipartisan support, broadly speaking, for renewable fuels, and as that production moves out of just the middle of the country, out of the farm states, into places like California and Oregon and the East Coast, that support tends to widen a little. And I think, you know, we've seen different parties in charge federally, and renewable fuel standard changes a little bit here and there, but it's maintained fairly steady over the years.
That's all I had. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Ready for a motion? Is there any other comments from people on the phone? Okay.
I move that the committee approve the request for $105 million in current year calendar year 2018 allocation for the Red Block biofuels project.
I wanted, before we ask for a second, I wanted to clarify. The department asked that if it's not used by, I think, April 6th, did you want to modify that?
Yeah.
And give it, because we usually do 180 days, so could you speak to that?
Yeah, your standard is 6 months.
Right.
We had initially requested April 6th, and thinking about this some more, this project is so complicated, has so many moving parts and players, I think building in some slack of...
That's why I asked about the April 18th. I heard you say that.
Yeah, maybe it was 2018, but...
Yes.
But, yeah, I think adding in some slack of another week or another 2 weeks or the end of April, I think, might...
Could I ask you to modify your motion?
Yeah, so I addend or add on to my motion that subject to... the amount converting back to the committee by April 30 of 2018 if, in fact, the remarketing doesn't close.
Okay. And the reason for that isn't to push out the closing date to April 29th.
Right.
It's, you know, if we're 99%
currently
there,
the
it
documents
needs a little more.
Have the April 5th remarketing date, so it would be very difficult to push behind, but it would give the possibility.
Well, even if you had to do something for a day or two, you could go into a short-term mode again. So, so with that modification restated, it's $105 million in current allocation, which use it or lose it, April 30th, 2018.
I second the motion.
All in favor, say aye.
Uh-huh. Aye.
Congratulations. Good luck.
And thank you very much.
Go forth and conquer.
We will.
So,
thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So our next item is a project that we've seen before, that we actually provided carry for last year, and I would ask the folks from Clackamas County Housing Authority to come up. I think there's been some project delays and price increases, and so they're looking for a small scale. To hear you from Clackamas Housing Authority, Rosewood Project.
Hi, so this is Chuck Robbins. I'm the Executive Director of the Housing Authority, and I'm here with our developers, Petco, which I think I just cut off.
Hey, well,
no, we're still here, Chuck.
All right.
So you've got the floor. Please go ahead and tell us about your request and give us a status update on the Rosewood apartment.
We are moving towards closing of March 1st. We have come to an agreement with U.S. Bank, and we're working through that agreement to get it closed on the equity. Since the last time we met, which would have been last January, we've had some price increases, and that's made U.S. Bank a little bit uncomfortable with regard to the 50% test. As of today, our bonds represent about 50.5% of the overall cost, and they asked if we could obtain some more bond volume. Get that number up, and that was the reason for this request of additional $2 million in bond volume. It'll take that 50.5% ratio up to 53.67% and provide a little bit more comfort with regard to that test.
And you already have all your tax credits lined up with Oregon Housing?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Any other questions from board members?
Yeah, just one technical question. Was there any change in the tax credit pricing between your two visits here a year apart?
There wasn't on this deal. They held pricing for us.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So it sounds like what sort of triggered the resulting delays was a concern raised by HUD about an exterior noise level.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's correct.
Been resolved?
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yes, we put noise attenuation in the buildings.
And HUD has signed off on your proposed engineering adjustments?
Yes, they have.
Great.
Okay. Any other questions from board members? Martha? Does anybody from housing want to speak to it? I mean, the tax credits in place?
Yeah, we're fine with it.
Okay. Thank you. Prepared to entertain a motion?
Sure. I would move that we allocate $2 million of 2018 volume cap to the Housing Authority of Clackamas County in further support of its Rosewood Terrace Apartments project.
I second it.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Congratulations. Thank
you. All right.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So our last presenter, and I put them last, I apologize, but because they have both a current allocation request, but they have also are going to come and talk to us, this is Home Forward, about their longer-term plans, and so I wanted them to have it in a unified fashion. So I invite Home Forward folks to come up to the podium because I think we'll be seeing them a bit this year.
Yes. Good to hear.
Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Teresa Aul, Finance Manager for Framework.
And I'm Jonathan Trett, the Director of Development for Home Forward. Thank you, Chair Lockwood McCall and committee members for this opportunity to talk both about Framework and then to give just a preview of some, I guess it's big P, preservation work that'll be coming through the pipeline over upcoming years. Let me start with Framework. You've seen this project before. It had an allocation of 2017 bond cap. And we returned that allocation because we needed a little more time to get to closing. Due to a couple of factors. One is just the innovation and the complexity of the project. And the other is with tax reform late last year, it was hard to get the attention of all the attorneys, investors, lenders out there for this project because they immediately went into triage mode and started trying to prioritize the projects that they knew they could get closed without a doubt by year's end. So we benefited from that in terms of our Northeast Grand project, which closed in December, 240 units underway. But that came a little bit at the expense of getting attention for Framework. So
we also benefited from a DDA being registered in the zip code that Framework is in. So we are eligible for 30% basis boost on the tax credit eligible basis for the property. And that was only in effect if we closed and issued the bonds after January 1, 2018.
So that makes good sense to
delay. Yes. So delay is not usually one's friend, but there are some exceptions to that rule. So really briefly, this is a mixed-use condominium at the site of the Albina Community Bank in the Perola. Northwest 10th and Northwest Gleason. It will have 60 units of affordable housing in a high-opportunity neighborhood, a mix of studios, ones and twos, 40 studios, 10 one-bedrooms, 10 two-bedrooms. In addition to being a housing development, it's also really an economic development project. This is going to be the first of its kind tall wood structure in the United States. So there's no steel, no concrete, providing any of the structure for the project, and it will use cross-laminated timber in its construction, which is a relatively new engineered wood product that is being produced here in Oregon. It's being produced in Canada, it's being produced in Europe right now. The only U.S. manufacturer of cross-laminated timber is D.R. Johnson in Riddle. So we've been interested in this project for many years because of the nexus between the affordable housing component, the economic development, and also the nexus between urban work and rural jobs. So we are gathering momentum towards the closing. We are very keen on closing as soon as possible, both because of the construction cost escalation that we see. Doesn't matter, market, affordable. What we're hearing from many general contractors is about 1% per month in the Portland market. And also, our tax credit pricing, we locked in pre-tax reform. The investor is holding the price, but they won't be patient forever. So we are working towards, we have a scheduled close date of February 21st. We are deep into due diligence calls, documents, board authorization, well on our way. One note about the information that we sent last January. I want to stress we've been doing this project in close coordination and collaboration with Oregon Housing, which has been a fantastic partner. And because of its innovation, There are some questions that we need to resolve about how much tax credit basis the hard costs generate. While it's typical for a building's hard costs to sort of one-for-one generate tax credits, there are things about an innovative project that I think are cause for conversation about how much basis the building will produce. So we are in active discussions with Oregon Housing about exactly how much of the hard costs will go into basis. Depending on the conclusions of those conversations, what you may see is some shift in the sources between how much fundraising there is versus how much tax credit equity there is. The key fundraising sources that we would go to are well aware of this discussion, and we are tracking towards memorializing their commitment. So there may be some ultimate shift in the sources. The uses are as shown there. And I wanted to say that in advance of providing Oregon Housing the opportunity to comment.
What does that mean? Do you need more bonding? Or?
No. Would not mean more bonding. I mean, it's basically, if you think of it as a closed system,
there's some other type of equity. Somebody else is kicking in some cash.
There's a lot of fundraising that is associated with this
project. I just wanted to know if you needed a little wiggle room in the allocation for bonds.
It's not in the bond side. It's really exactly where things line up between the extent to which the governor finds some funding for the project, the extent to which we need to do additional fundraising, and the amount of, as Oregon Housing continues to review the application, the amount of hard costs that are ultimately determined to be tax credit basis eligible, consistent with their responsibilities.
Some of this is an economic development project.
And that's the discussion.
Okay.
So that's one of the things I think it'd be appropriate to highlight. So let me stop talking and ask if you have questions.
Does anyone from Oregon Housing want to speak as well, since they're your partners in this new endeavor?
Good morning. I'm Casey Bauman, Underwriting Manager, Multifamily Section of OHCS. And as Jonathan said, we are working with Home Forward on these construction costs and ensuring that any innovation costs or costs attributable to the CLT and economic development are pulled out of eligible basis. As of right now, we are not set on a tax credit allocation, which could potentially result in a with the loss of the allocation. And, you know, from what I understand, we have some preliminary construction costs, and we'll, you know, further our conversation with Jonathan and his team to determine our tax credit allocation.
So that's why in the sources we have grants obtained or requested, additional fundraising needed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Additional fundraising needed may, as these conversations come to a conclusion, we'll know exactly how much fundraising is needed. We know which foundation would provide those funds. We have our council already working with their council in terms of creating the, dare I say, framework for a legal agreement.
A framework for framework.
But exactly what numbers are going to go into those lines are going to be subject to the conclusion of these discussions.
Okay. And just to be perfectly clear, in the sources and uses schedule, the $1.9 million labeled additional fundraising needed, that's a resource which is not committed today?
There's a head nod commitment. It is not documented.
Okay, so that's something this also has to be nailed down for you to close this in March.
Absolutely. I mean,
in addition to this mix shift issue.
Yes, I mean, that you know, we're doing this project in partnership with another developer. It's really their relationship with this foundation that enables me to come here and say that we're sure the sources and uses are going to balance. I've been stressing to them repeatedly that to get to closing, partners like Oregon Housing and Community Services, or PHB, are going to need to see that commitment documented. And we're very close, but we don't have it in writing just yet.
It's been observed about this project by multiple folks that this is expensive. And to kind of put that in context, the cost per door of Rosewood that we acted on 15 minutes ago,
right,
is this project is 50% more per door than Rosewood. It's expensive.
It is.
Given that, talk to us about replicability and scalability.
I think that the issue here is really about creating a demand for CLT and showing that there is that there is a replicable path to building tall wood buildings and using only CLT. So I could say that all of the research and development, which was grant-funded, is really open source. So there was a whole bunch of work that was done to get to building permit that is now available to anybody else who wants to do this. So the
not
next
just residential, but also commercial.
Right, commercial. I mean, it's really about the structural integrity of a building that's that tall, that's built entirely out of wood. So. The intent is not so much about affordable housing and building the next tower of affordable housing out of CLT as it is being part of a process that demonstrates the replicability of this construction material in this type of construction. So I think in terms of the economic development piece, you're going to see a lot more of the replicability in terms of the affordable housing piece as we all focus on what it costs, whatever metric we want to use. I don't know that there's going to be a lot more 11-story towers built entirely out of CLT.
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand what you're telling me.
Yeah.
If you were to pick this thing up and build it again at some other site in Portland, would it cost this much? Or are there one-time costs associated with this one that we will never see again or are not likely to see at this magnitude again?
Oh, I think it would cost less. This has been part of the discussion. It's a really nuanced challenge to go through and identify exactly what is driven, which of the costs are driven by CLT versus which of the costs are driven by the fact that this is a boldly commercial job on a quarter block in downtown Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to pick this building up and leaving aside the construction cost escalation and move it, you know, three blocks north or south, it would cost less because there's a lot less work that we would need to do in order to get to the building permit, in order to get all of the financing partners to understand what the technology is and why they can trust it.
So some of it's location specific.
A lot of it is location specific. I mean, and this has been one of the interesting things in this discussion is that there aren't a lot of comparable. When you look at affordable housing developments built in downtown Portland, very few of them have been on a quarter block. They tend to be on a much bigger parcel, at least a half block, often a full block, and these are 4% tax credit deals that at some point have come in front of PAVC. And there are all kinds of economies of scale that come out of building on a bigger parcel and building more units. I mean, one of the things about, I mean, when I talk about a quarter block, it's a 5,000 square foot floor plate that we're dealing with, or excuse me, 10,000 square feet, which if you're driving through northeast Portland or southeast Portland close in, that's two single family lots. So if you can imagine building 60 units on something that compressed, up six stories, that's
lots,
a big car.
Lots of plumbing.
Lots of plumbing, but just lots of logistics about a crane is a crane, and there's all kinds of aspects in terms of how much skin a building has, sort of skin per square foot of residential, rentable residential space that generates debt that you can leverage when you build at a quarter block versus a half block, mm-hmm. that drive costs.
Okay, well, I certainly hope it proves to be scalable and replicable. Otherwise, this is going to be a hell of an expensive demo project and experiment.
There is replicability to it, and I think CLT as a product is something that you're going to see in a lot of applications, whether it's, say, traditional stick-built four-story versus tall buildings as well. So. And I'll be back in front of this committee. You'll have plenty of chances to ask me about it.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Other questions? Other questions?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
I'm ready to entertain a motion for this item.
Yes. I'll go ahead. I move that the committee approve a $17 million volume cap to Home Forward for the Framework Housing Project at 2018 allocation.
Is there a second?
Yes, there is.
All in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Congratulations. We're going to give you the full 6 months.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Just because.
It should be interesting to see how it turns out, being sort of a first for this project.
Yeah, we're excited. We are excited about it.
And you of course, are guaranteeing that the legislative delegation from Douglas County will support every initiative of the governor.
Yes.
This might be one way there.
Yes.
It would be great.
On the record.
I need to throw out a small correction. It is in full 6 months. It's 150 days.
Oh, okay. Excuse me.
Okay.
We'll give you the full 150 days.
Understood. and appreciate it.
Okay. Okay, so the other item is for folks from Home Forward to give us, and I've asked Jonathan to do this back when we were in December, November, talking about all the upcoming work. I guess there's some things that are not quite ready from an Oregon housing perspective,
right,
but that are definitely going to be in the pipeline this coming year. So I thought if you could walk us through, that's the last item in our board package, which
sure,
is no item, but in the past we've gotten, you know, forward presentations from Home Forward.
Sure.
And so go ahead.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, and at your suggestion, we prepared really some the preliminary materials to try to give some sense of what will be coming back to the committee to talk about in future months and years. So what we're engaged in right now is the full portfolio conversion of our public housing portfolio. So this is a portfolio of, as of a few years ago, was approximately 3,652 units. It was a portfolio that was created under a really different notion of how to provide this aspect of our social infrastructure that is affordable housing, more of a New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society notion of affordable housing, where these were, and to the extent that they're still public housing, these are assets that they don't have any debt, they don't use any of the traditional affordable housing financing tools in order to be maintained over years. So there's no debt on them, there's no tax credit equity, and we as the housing authority and other housing authorities throughout the state are reliant on Congress to appropriate operating and capital dollars year in and year out. And there's a fair amount of volatility, though there is a trend line going down. So our board, our organization, decided a few years ago that what we want to do in order to preserve this crucial community asset that's providing housing and rental subsidy to among the very most low-income household in Multnomah County is to go through this conversion, which it gets a little technical, but fundamentally we're moving to a Section 8 mechanism for receiving operating subsidy, and looking to leverage the properties with debt and bring in tax credit equity to take care of their capital needs. And the theory behind this is that there are, I don't remember the exact number, but there are a few thousand housing authorities around the nation. There are lots of notions, accurate and often inaccurate, of what public housing is. There are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of landlords who receive Section 8 payments. And so the Section 8 program, when one looks at a political crystal ball, to the extent it's sensible to make predictions, the Section 8 program is a little more robust, has a little bit more, you could say, political support, is a little harder for Congress to go after. So that,
it's all the landlords of the universe.
More stakeholders.
There's more stakeholders, and through the tax credit program, frankly, many of them are large banks. That have either bought tax credits or lend on affordable housing properties. So as we look to the future and look to maintain these assets, we decided to go through this portfolio conversion. Much of that is going to be done through a program called RAD, or the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program. There may be other housing authorities who you have seen, I think Salem may have done a few, but who you have seen or will see, who will be using RAD for similar reasons, and combining a RAD conversion with some 4% tax credits and working through your portfolios or on particular projects. We are using another type of Section 8, another flavor, it's a little bit like Baskin-Robbins, of Section 8 in conjunction with RAD Section 8 that provides actually a little bit more operating subsidy per unit that enables us to combine different projects into bundles and move forward with financing them. So there is a graphic that Ben Loftus from our shop put together to lay out the full timeline of what this portfolio conversion looks like and to give a sense of where we are. And let's see, do you have it? It's multicolored? Okay. Okay, so we have completed phase one and phase two. And what you're going to be seeing from us in future months and years is phase three. And what I'd say about phase three is that you have these bundles of properties, generally 6 to 8 properties at a time. And within each bundle, what you have is inevitably a larger property, often a tower of approximately 100 units, combined with many smaller properties ranging anywhere from 10 to 40 units. And the idea is that the larger properties, which get the more robust flavor of Section 8, the higher operating subsidy per unit, are really providing the scale that enables us to, in these scattered site groupings, finance and rehabilitate these in packages. So group 5 is going to be the first group that you'll see coming through later this year. We intend to have a pre-application into Oregon Housing in April and then be back in front of the Private Activity Bond Committee also in April looking for an allocation of approximately $35 million of private activity bond authorization to move forward and move forward towards a closing in the fourth quarter of 2018, and move on with the rehab, the temporary relocation as we spruce up units, and we'll be bringing these groups forward roughly in 6 month intervals. So the first of them, the group 5, we've already hired the architecture and engineering firms. They're out walking the units. We're doing all kinds of work that HUD requires in terms of capital needs assessments. We've hired the general contractor. We have requests for proposals related to the temporary relocation during construction and also our financing that will be going out in February. So we're rolling along, and you'll see us back in April as we continue to build momentum towards a financing closing and a start of construction in the last quarter of this year.
How much is phase three in total, ballpark?
In terms of the total number of...
just the bonding.
I think each bundle is going to be approximately between 30 and 40 million.
So
we'll say 120 to 160.
But it's not going to all happen in 1 year.
No. If we one can always improve, and I'm realizing one thing that I should have asked to be put on here is roughly when these will be coming through Private Activity Bond Committee. We can update this the next time we're here.
Sure.
But you know, starting with April of this year, you can imagine these coming forward in 6 month intervals.
So, are we likely to see Group 6 in the back half of 2018?
Yes, you are.
And that will also be approximately $35 million.
35 to 40.
I'll wiggle a little bit and say up to 40.
Okay.
Just because it has more properties.
Right. And Group 7, 8, and 9 are going to be 2019 or later events.
Yes, that's true. And I would say that Group 6 has two Medallion apartments and Williams apartments are both towers, both of which need significant renovation of their envelope. And potentially significant seismic improvement. So I'm saying that's why I'm hedging more towards 40 on Group 6.
Sure.
I know that Dan asked us a lot, but changes in the tax credit market,
yeah.
Did that affect the number of the debt versus tax credit to the extent tax credit discount?
I'll go and you should go. I mean, the debt is what the projects can support based on the rent level. We have heard, I imagine OHCS has heard lots of things too, the tax credit pricing may be down as much as 10 to 15% from where it was fourth quarter 2017.
Would these projects then qualify for any kind of LIFT? They probably wouldn't qualify for GAP funding under the current LIFT program.
So the LIFT program is targeted to union production.
That's what I was asking.
We do have our eye on the big P NOFA that I think is covered for later this year to be a part of the financing package. Anything you want to add on the tax credit piece?
We are pulling the tax credit investors that we've used before, and what we're hearing from them is even though the industry says that there's a 15% drop, that 15% drop isn't down from where we see framework pricing right now. It's really right around there. So they're saying 95 cents is reasonable to project, and I think that's what we have in our projections for these properties.
Well, we'll get to hear more about it as time unfolds, whether those can hold or...
It turns out I live near Williams Plaza.
Oh, do you? Okay, yeah.
And, of course, Williams Plaza has a surface parking lot, which is pretty high-value dirt in that geography. Are you doing anything to recover value from that?
No, but we should.
He's willing to pay for a rental space for a parking
space. One of the tales of close-in locations in the city of Portland in the last couple of years is things that had been surface parking forever ain't no more.
What's going to happen?
No, you make a good point. get so focused on answering HUD questions and going through their process that is helpful hearing outside voice.
No, there is a bunch of buried value there if you can extract it.
Right.
And it's non-trivial.
No, well, and the nice thing is it's far enough out that we have time to think about how you might partition the lot, the parking lot off. And
I'd ask that question about any property you own if it's got a parking lot.
Yeah. I'm going to start asking.
Okay. It's wonderful that you're kind of sharing where you're going with this. I think the initiative is absolutely the right thing to do. And, just sort of looking at the unit count, you're like 65% of the way through this already with phases one and two. This is not like an experiment. And you've actually probably learned a whole bunch about the granular mechanics of this.
Yes. Yes.
Great. It's really helpful to see this bigger picture and kind of know what the plans are going forward. So I appreciate you putting this together.
Yeah.
Well, great. Any other questions?
No. Come back and see us tonight.
Any public comments? If not, I adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much. And look forward to a wonderful 2018 for everybody and our various innovative projects around our state.
Thank you.
Your conference is ending now. As requested by the host, please hang up.